Chapter 2 Olivia dreamed, and through her dreams crawled a suggestion of lurking evil, like a black serpent writhing through flower gardens. Her dreams were fragmentary and colorful, exotic shards of a broken unknown pattern, until they crystallized into a scene of horror and madness, etched against a background of cyclopean stones and pillars. She saw a great hall whose lofty ceiling was upheld by stone columns marching in even rows among the massive walls. Among these pillars fluttered great green and scarlet parrots, and the hall was thronged with black-skinned, hawk-faced warriors. They were not Negroes. Neither they, nor their garments, nor their weapons resembled anything of the world the dreamer knew. They were pressing about one bound to a pillar, a slender, white-skinned youth, with a cluster of golden curls about his alabaster brow. His beauty was not altogether human, like the dream of a god chiseled out of living marble. The black warriors laughed at him, jeered and taunted in a strange tongue. The lithe, naked form writhed beneath their cruel hands. Blood trickled down the ivory thighs to splatter on the polished floor. The screams of the victim echoed through the hall. Then, lifting his head toward the ceiling and the skies beyond, he cried out a name in an awful voice. A dagger in an ebon hand cut short the cry, and the golden head rolled on the ivory breast. As if in answer to that desperate cry, there was a rolling thunder as of celestial chariot wheels, and a figure stood before the slayers, as if materialized out of empty air. The form was of a man, but no mortal man ever wore such an aspect of inhuman beauty. There was an unmistakable resemblance between him and the youth who drooped lifeless in his chains, but the alloy of humanity that softened the godliness of the youth was lacking in the features of the stranger, awful and immobile in their beauty. The blacks shrank back before him, their eyes slits of fire. Lifting a hand, he spoke, and his tones echoed through the silent halls in deep, rich waves of sound. Like men in a trance, the black warriors fell back until they were ranged along the walls in regular lines. Then, from the stranger's chiseled lips, rang a terrible invocation and command.
Yogkulan Yoktha, Zuthala!
At the blast of that awful cry, the black figures stiffened and froze. Over their limbs crept a curious rigidity, an unnatural petrification. The stranger touched the limp body of the youth, and the chains fell away from it. He lifted the corpse in his arms. Then, ere he turned away, his tranquil gaze swept again over the silent rows of ebony figures, and he pointed to the moon, which gleamed in through the casements. And they understood, those tense, waiting statues that had been men. Olivia awoke, starting up on her couch of branches, a cold sweat beading her skin. Her heart pounded loud in the silence. She glanced wildly about. Conan slept against the pillar, his head fallen upon his massive breast. The silvery radiance of the late moon crept through the gaping roof, throwing long white lines on the dusty floor. She could see the images dimly, black, tense, waiting. Fighting down a rising hysteria, she saw the moonbeams rest lightly on the pillars and the shapes between. What was that? A tremor among the shadows where the moonlight fell. A paralysis of horror gripped her, for where there should have been the immobility of death, there was movement. A slow twitching, a flexing and writhing of ebon limbs. An awful scream burst from her lips as she broke the bonds that held her mute and motionless. At her shriek, Conan shot erect, teeth gleaming, sword lifted.
"The statues! The statues! Oh my God, the statues are coming to life!"
And with the cry she sprang through a crevice in the wall, burst madly through the hindering vines and ran blind, screaming, witless, until a grasp on her arm brought her up short, and she shrieked and fought against the arms that caught her, until a familiar voice penetrated the mists of her terror, and she saw Conan's face, a mask of bewilderment in the moonlight.
"What in Crom's name, girl? Did you have a nightmare?"
His voice sounded strange and far away. With a sobbing gasp, she threw her arms about his thick neck and clung to him convulsively, crying in panting catches.
"Where are they? Did they follow us?"
"Nobody followed us," he answered.
She sat up, still clinging to him, and looked fearfully about. Her blind flight had carried her to the southern edge of the plateau. Just below them was the slope, its foot masked in the thick shadows of the woods. Behind them, she saw the ruins looming in the high swinging moon.
Did you not see them? The statues, moving, lifting their hands, their eyes glaring in the shadows.
I saw nothing, answered the barbarian uneasily. I slept more soundly than usual, because it has been so long since I have slumbered the night through, yet I don't think anything could have entered the hall without waking me.
Nothing entered?
A laugh of hysteria escaped her.
It was something there already. Oh, Mitra, we lay down to sleep among them, like sheep making their bed in the shambles.
What are you talking about? He demanded. I awoke at your cry, but before I had time to look about me, I saw you rush out through a crack in the wall. I pursued you, lest you come to harm. I thought you had a nightmare.
So I did,
she shivered.
But the reality was more grisly than the dream. Listen.
And she narrated all that she had dreamed and thought to see. Conan listened attentively. The natural skepticism of the sophisticated man was not his. His mythology contained ghouls, goblins, and necromancers. After she had finished, he sat silent, absently toying with his sword.
The youth they tortured was like the tall man who came?
He asked at last.
As like as son to father,
she answered, and hesitantly.
If the mind could conceive of the offspring of a union of divinity with humanity, it would picture that youth. The gods of old times mated sometimes with mortal women, our legends tell us.
What gods?
He muttered.
The nameless forgotten ones. Who knows? They have gone back into the still waters of the lakes, the quiet hearts of the hills, the gulfs beyond the stars. Gods are no more stable than men.
But if these shapes were men, blasted into iron images by some god or devil, how can they come to life?
There is witchcraft in the moon,
she shuddered.
He pointed at the moon while the moon shines on them. They live, so I believe.
But we were not pursued,
muttered Conan, glancing toward the brooding ruins.
You might have dreamed they moved. I am of a mind to return and see.
No, no, no,
she cried, clutching at him desperately.
Perhaps the spell upon them holds them in the hall. Do not go back. They will rend you limb from limb. Oh, Conan, let us go to our boat and flee this awful island. Surely the Hyrcanian ship has passed us now. Let us go.
So frantic was her pleading that Conan was impressed. His curiosity in regards to the images was balanced by his superstition. Foes of flesh and blood he did not fear, however great the odds, but any hint of the supernatural roused all the dim, monstrous instincts of fear that are the heritage of the barbarian. He took the girl's hand and they went down the slope and plunged into the dense woods where the leaves whispered and nameless nightbirds murmured drowsily. Under the trees the shadows clustered thick, and Conan swerved to avoid the denser patches. His eyes roved continuously from side to side and often flitted into the branches above them. He went quickly yet warily, his arm girdling the girl's waist so strongly that she felt as if she were being carried rather than guided. Neither spoke. The only sound was the girl's quick, nervous panting, the rustle of her small feet in the grass. So they came through the trees to the edge of the water, shimmering like molten silver in the moonlight.
We should have brought fruit for food,
muttered Conan.
But doubtless we'll find other islands. As well leave now as later. It's but a few hours till dawn.
His voice trailed away. The painter was still made fast to the looping root, but at the other end was only a smashed and shattered ruin, half submerged in the shallow water. A stifled cry escaped Olivia. Conan wheeled and faced the dense shadows, a crouching image of menace. The noise of the nightbirds was suddenly silent. A brooding stillness reigned over the woods. No breeze moved the branches, yet somewhere the leaves stirred faintly. Quick as a great cat, Conan caught up Olivia and ran. Through the shadows he raced like a phantom, while somewhere above and behind them sounded a curious rushing among the leaves that implacably drew closer and closer. Then the moonlight burst full upon their faces, and they were speeding up the slope of the plateau. At the crest, Conan laid Olivia down and turned to glare back at the gulf of shadows they had just quitted. The leaves shook in a sudden breeze, that was all. He shook his mane with an angry growl. Olivia crept to his feet like a frightened child. Her eyes looked up at him, dark wells of horror.
What are we to do, Conan?
She whispered. He looked at the ruins, stared again into the woods below.
We'll go to the cliffs,
he declared, lifting her to her feet. Tomorrow I'll make a raft, and we'll trust our luck to the sea again.
It was not they that destroyed our boat?
It was half question, half assertion. He shook his head, grim and taciturn. Every step of the way across that moon-haunted plateau was a sweating terror for Olivia, but no black shapes stole subtly from the looming ruins, and at last they reached the foot of the crags, which rose stark and gloomily majestic above them. There Conan halted in some uncertainty, at last selecting a place sheltered by a broad ledge, nowhere near any trees.
"Lie down and sleep if you can, Olivia," he said. "I'll keep watch."
But no sleep came to Olivia, and she lay watching the distant ruins in the wooded rim until the stars paled and the east whitened and dawn in rose and gold struck fire from the dew on the grass blades. She rose stiffly, her mind reverting to all the happenings of the night. In the morning light, some of its terrors seemed like figments of an overwrought imagination. Conan strode over to her, and his words electrified her.
"Just before dawn I heard the creak of timbers and the rasp and clack of cordage and oars. A ship has put in and anchored at the beach not far away, probably the ship whose sail we saw yesterday. We'll go up on the cliffs and spy on her."
Up they went, and lying on their bellies among the boulders, saw a painted mast jutting up beyond the trees to the west.
"A Hyrcanian craft from the cut of her rigging," muttered Conan. "I wonder if the crew..."
A distant medley of voices reached their ears, and creeping to the southern edge of the cliffs, they saw a motley horde emerge from the fringe of trees along the western rim of the plateau, and stand there a space in debate. There was much flourishing of arms, brandishing of swords, and loud, rough argument. Then the whole band started across the plateau toward the ruins, at a slant that would take them close by the foot of the cliffs.
"Pirates," whispered Conan, a grim smile on his thin lips. "It's a Hyrcanian galley they've captured. Here, crawl among these rocks. Don't show yourself unless I call to you," he instructed, having secreted her to his satisfaction among the tangle of boulders along the crest of the cliffs. "I'm going to meet these dogs. If I succeed in my plan, all will be well and we'll sail away with them. If I don't succeed, well, hide yourself in the rocks until they're gone, for no devils on this island are as cruel as these sea wolves."
And tearing himself away from her reluctant grasp, he swung quickly down the cliffs. Looking fearfully from her eyrie, Olivia saw the band had neared the foot of the cliffs. Even as she looked, Conan stepped from among the boulders and faced them, sword in hand. They gave back with yells of menace and surprise, then halted uncertainly to glare at this figure which had appeared so suddenly from the rocks. There were some 70 of them, a wild horde made up of men from many nations, Carthians, Amorians, Brethunians, Corinthians, Shemites. Their features reflected the wildness of their natures. Many bore the scars of the lash or the branding iron. There were cropped ears, slit noses, gaping eye sockets, stumps of wrists, marks of the hangman as well as scars of battle. Most of them were half-naked, but the garments they wore were fine. Gold-braided jackets, satin girdles, silken breeches, tattered, stained with tar and blood, vied with pieces of silver-chased armor. Jewels glittered in nose rings and earrings and in the hilts of their daggers. Over against this bizarre mob stood the tall Sumerian, in strong contrast with his hard bronze limbs and clean-cut vital features.
"Who are you?"
they roared.
"Conan the Sumerian."
His voice was like the deep challenge of a lion.
"One of the Free Companions. I mean to try my luck with the Red Brotherhood. Who's your chief?"
"I, by Ishtar,"
bellowed a bull-like voice as a huge figure swaggered forward, a giant, naked to the waist where his capacious belly was girdled by a wide sash that upheld voluminous silken pantaloons. His head was shaven except for a scalp lock, and his mustaches drooped over a rat-trap mouth. Green shemitish slippers with upturned toes were on his feet, a long, straight sword in his hand. Conan stared and glared.
"Sergius of Crotia, by Crom."
"Aye, by Ishtar,"
boomed the giant, his small black eyes glittering with hate.
"Did you think I had forgot? Ha! Sergius never forgets an enemy. Now I'll hang you up by the heels and skin you alive. At him, lads!"
"Aye, send your dogs at me, big belly," sneered Conan with bitter scorn. "You always were a coward, you Gothic cur."
"Coward? To me?"
The broad face turned black with passion.
On guard, you northern dog! I'll cut out your heart!
In an instant, the pirates had formed a circle about the rivals, their eyes blazing, their breath sucking between teeth in bloodthirsty enjoyment. High up among the crags, Olivia watched, sinking her nails into her palms in her painful excitement. Without formality, the combatants engaged, Sergius coming in with a rush, quick on his feet as a giant cat for all his bulk. Curses hissed between his clenched teeth as he lustily swung and parried. Conan fought in silence, his eyes slits of blue balefire. The Kothian ceased his oaths to save his breath. The only sounds were the quick scuff of feet on the sword, the panting of the pirate, the clash and ring of steel. The swords flashed like white fire in the early sun, wheeling and circling. They seemed to recoil from each other's contact, then leap together again instantly. Sergius was giving back. Only his superlative skill had saved him thus far from the blinding speed of the Cimmerian's onslaught. A louder clash of steel, a sliding rasp, a choking cry, and from the pirate horde a fierce yell split the morning as Conan's sword plunged through their captain's massive body. The point quivered an instant from between Sergius' shoulders, a hand's breadth of white fire in the sunlight. Then the Cimmerian wrenched back his steel and the pirate chief fell heavily, face down, and lay in a widening pool of blood, his broad hands twitching for an instant. Conan wheeled toward the gaping corsairs.
"Well, you dogs,"
he roared,
"I've sent your chief to hell. What says the law of the Red Brotherhood?"
Before any could answer, a rat-faced Brethunian, standing behind his fellows, whirled a sling swiftly and deadly. Straight as an arrow sped the stone to its mark, and Conan reeled and fell as a tall tree falls to the woodsman's axe. Up on the cliff, Olivia caught at the boulders for support. The scene swam dizzily before her eyes. All she could see was the Cimmerian lying limply on the sward, blood oozing from his head. The rat-faced one yelped in triumph and ran to stab the prostrate man, but a lean Corinthian thrust him back.
"What, Aratus, would you break the law of the Brotherhood, you dog?"
"No law is broken,"
snarled the Brethunian.
"No law? Why, you dog, this man you have just struck down is by just rights our captain."
"Nay,"
shouted Aratus.
"He was not of our band, but an outsider. He had not been admitted to fellowship. Slaying Sergius does not make him captain, as would have been the case had one of us killed him."
"But he wished to join us,"
retorted the Corinthian.
"He said so."
At that a great clamor arose, some siding with Aratus, some with the Corinthian, whom they called Ivanos. Oaths flew thick, challenges were passed, hands fumbled at sword hilts. At last a Shemite spoke up over the clamor.
"Why do you argue over a dead man?"
"He's not dead,"
answered the Corinthian, rising from beside the prostrate Cimmerian.
"It was only a glancing blow. He's only stunned."
At that the clamor rose anew, Aratus trying to get at the senseless man, and Ivanos finally bestriding him sword in hand and defying all and sundry. Olivia sensed that it was not so much in defense of Conan that the Corinthian took his stand, but in opposition to Aratus. Evidently these men had been Sergius' lieutenants, and there was no love lost between them. After more arguments, it was decided to bind Conan and take him along with them, his fate to be voted on later. The Cimmerian, who was beginning to regain consciousness, was bound with leather girdles, and then four pirates lifted him and with many complaints and curses carried him along with the band, which took up its journey across the plateau once more. The body of Sergius was left where it had fallen, a sprawling, unlovely shape on the sun-washed sward. Up among the rocks, Olivia lay stunned by the disaster. She was incapable of speech or action and could only lie there and stare with horrified eyes as the brutal horde dragged her protector away. How long she lay there, she did not know. Across the plateau, she saw the pirates reach the ruins and enter, dragging their captive. She saw them swarming in and out of the doors and crevices, prodding into the heaps of debris and clambering about the walls. After a while, a score of them came back across the plateau and vanished among the trees on the western rim, dragging the body of Sergius after them, presumably to cast into the sea. About the ruins, the others were cutting down trees and securing materials for a fire. Olivia heard their shouts, unintelligible in the distance, and she heard the voices of those who had gone into the woods echoing among the trees. Presently they came back into sight, bearing casks of liquor and leathern sacks of food. They headed for the ruins, cursing lustily under their burdens. Of all this, Olivia was but mechanically cognizant. Her overwrought brain was almost ready to collapse. Left alone and unprotected, she realized how much the protection of the Cimmerian had meant to her, There intruded vaguely a wonderment at the mad pranks of fate that could make the daughter of a king the companion of a red-handed barbarian. With it came a revulsion toward her own kind. Her father and Shah Amaranth, they were civilized men, and from them she had had only suffering. She had never encountered any civilized man who treated her with kindness unless there was an ulterior motive behind his actions. Conan had shielded her, protected her, and so far demanded nothing in return. Laying her head in her rounded arms, she wept, until distant shouts of ribald rivalry roused her to her own danger. She glanced from the dark ruins, about which the fantastic figures small in the distance weaved and staggered, to the dusky depths of the green forest. Even if her terrors in the ruins the night before had been only dreams, the menace that lurked in those green leafy depths below were no figment of nightmare. Were Conan slain or carried away captive, her only choice would lie between giving herself up to the human wolves of the sea or remaining alone on that devil-haunted island. As the full horror of her situation swept over her, she fell forward in a swoon.